The other thing is what we're also drawing attention to the fact is that what we're talking about here is people, human beings. We also need to pay attention to the humanity of people involved in these historical moments. And I want to first turn to Canetta, really. In your book, London is a Place for Me, you make a choice that you want to look at a consideration of the perspectives, I'm going to quote you here, perspectives, organizing strategies, and the political activities of Black Britons. That's what you want to focus on. You also say that actually that means we need to look at alternative historical texts. So I invite you to sort of say a little bit about why that was important, that particular consideration, and then tell us what alternative historical texts opened up those particular organizing strategies. Where do we look for those particular things? And then I've got a sort of similar question for Robin and Abdul to kind of follow in, because it's I think what we're talking about is the need to attend to human agency. Because there's a real danger that if you don't, then actually we create other sets of problems.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. For me, I think this question is about the end of the day when we're constructing historical narratives, we are making a choice about illuminating certain kinds of perspectives. And one of my problems with the discipline sometimes, and also the ways that curriculum get constructed, is that we don't name who we are absenting, and we're not naming whose voices we're privileging in the histories that we tell. And I think that is the fundamental issue. So yes, I'm very aware that the history that I have written in London is the Place for Me. There's a vantage point that I'm trying to get at that I think is oftentimes underrepresented in histories of contemporary Britain, and thinking about the politics of race, migration, and citizenship during that period. So I was choosing a position to create a narrative that was going to give us a perspective on that. I think part of the time as well, when we're designing curriculum, and part of the critique of where Black history or where histories of any kind of racially minoritized group in society are represented in history, one of the things that we're not oftentimes signaling is that a perspective has been represented, but it's been represented as a universal, as a stand-in for everyone. And essentially, those are oftentimes sort of Eurocentric perspectives that are presented as if this is history writ large for everyone, or this is history, all the history that matters for everyone. And so I think, again, but it's also reinscribing a kind of very, I would argue, you know, sort of advancing very Eurocentric, even white nationalist projects. It's something that I've even written about, is that history gets very easily implicated when we're not clear about whose perspectives we're privileging in our historical narratives. And that's not to say that, you know, I think people slip too easily sometimes and sort of say, well, oh, we don't want to be biased in history. And I'm like, but we do have a perspective. We do have voices, that there is a politics as historians when we're thinking about our historical narratives. There are people that we become invested in our narratives. It's important to acknowledge that in our narratives and whose voices are being privileged, because I don't even think individual historians can write sort of history writ large that tells everybody's story. And I don't think in our history classes, our goal should be to represent, if we're teaching a world history class, to really represent that, like, you're getting 500 years of all the history that you need to know in these courses. So I do think, you know, even in my own teaching, I've tried to sort of say, if I'm teaching those general courses about big subject areas, you know, I try to say, you know, these are some of the perspectives and voices and themes that we are going to be more invested in this semester. And I think it's political to really be upfront about that. And I think we really, it's really dangerous not to mark when we do that. And oftentimes when we don't mark it, we're oftentimes privileging a very kind of Eurocentric perspective of the world.
So Canetta, I don't know whether you want to sort of add anything around agency and sources.
Sure. I mean, I think to that point about, you know, once we are settled on, you know, what perspectives we're really invested in terms of the narratives that we're constructing historically, I do think in my case, it definitely was trying to think beyond a very traditional archive space about race and political culture in Britain that was kind of moving beyond government records and trying to look at sources that allowed me to see people represented on their own terms outside of how they might have been represented in the media and how they might have been represented as a problem that the state was now sort of managing. So it's not that those sources weren't important in terms of helping me to build that picture, but I wanted to try to find voices that helped me, give me glimpses of some of the people that I wanted to kind of really animate the narrative that I wanted to tell on their own terms. And that's where turning to things like music and calypso and photographs were really important in terms of trying to expand our notions of what the archive of Black British history is. And I think oftentimes when we're trying to get at stories that are often stories of communities whose histories are often marginalized in traditional archival spaces, we do have to think beyond very traditional sources. We do have to think about, again, sources that may never make it into some sort of official repository. And that's why I think the Young Historians Project, they had a really excellent series over the summer. And one of the things they talked about was like the importance of things like oral histories. How do you get at some of the stories and pathways into history that are not going to ever be held at the National Archives, no matter how important that they are? I think related to that is also our practices around reading the archives. I'm working right now on a book on David Oluwole, someone who, for all intents and purposes, I don't expect to find many sources that would be representative of him on his own terms. I'm working with an archive, admittedly, that he might not even recognize himself in. It's a very rich archive, but it's an archive that frames him as criminal, as someone who's disposable, as someone who's dispossessed, and someone who doesn't matter. But there again, there are all of these ways in which the ways that he bumps up with the state creates a real footprint for him. So the question then for me is, what kinds of methodologies do I bring to reading that archive to try to think about, you know, what the representations are there, what representations are there in the archive, but how I can disrupt some of the power dynamics that are at play in that archive. And again, one of the things I'm trying to think about is things like the sensory registers of an archive. What are the sounds that come out of an archive? You know, how can we use the ways in which sound and the visual registers of this archive to interrupt the ways in which this archive is trying to just continually represent him as this disrespectable, subhuman criminal? And so I think it's both about expanding the purview of how we imagine what constitutes the archive, and then also the practices that we use to read those archives. I think those both open up space to offer in or lend different kinds of perspectives that are oftentimes, you know, not represented in historical narratives.
That's brilliant. And I think you actually brought it back to perspective, because in a sense, what we're also trying to do there is reveal the perspective of the archive. Because that's not a neutral space. That's actually got an agenda. And actually, how well do we understand that? You know, because decisions are being made about what's collected, how it's preserved, et cetera, and they're made at certain different moments. But also, yeah, I mean, I was just spent time in the George Padmore archive looking at some of the boxes from the New Cross fire and just seeing the New Cross organizing committee's badges as evidence, you know, and how interesting that might be to young people in a classroom, because actually it begins to ask questions about, well, what constitutes an evidential base for an inquiry? What types of archives exist in relation to that?